So when the overall synthetic rubber program ended in 1955, you were transferred to the National Science Foundation to oversee the rundown of the research program. Mm-hmm. Why was the National Science Foundation chosen, and when was it decided that it would in fact be turned over to them?
Well, the National Science Foundation was a going concern to sponsor basic research, and since most of the development type activity was not except for that for the government laboratories, this is going to be largely a matter of supporting the university research. It just seemed logical that to turn it over to them, since they're supposed to be the stronghold of research. And
so when was that decision made? When was it decided that it would finally go?
The disposal commission decided that.
Did they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, would it have been possible to have terminated the research program in July 1955 and forgotten about the rundown?
Just chopped it off when they sold the plants. I suppose you could have done it, I guess, and there's some of those projects that it was better to sort of taper them off and to just chop them off short. For one thing, you might it gave the industry a chance to decide whether it wanted to pick up any of these university research groups and keep on supporting them rather than just throwing them out for pot luck to the government.
Right.
And
did anything particularly noteworthy happen in these last 18 months? From your point of view?
No, I don't think so. Of course, if you just chopped it off short, there wasn't any, there might have been.
Well, let me ask another question which might sort of express it slightly better. I mean, were there any developments or projects that were coming down the pipeline in 54, 55 that you would like to have seen completed under your direction?
No, they were pretty, there wasn't anything then. It was, it looked like it needed any attention other than what it would get from the rubber companies.
Right. And would you have liked the research program, the Pacific synthetic rubber research program, to have continued at least in a modest way after 1956? I mean, do you think it would have pretty much stopped it?
Well, it could have been done. Matter of fact, I proposed one way of doing it, but I don't know that it needed to be done with. With both, with those two things, with Firestone and Goodrich having come out with those syntheses of cis polyisoprene, that That opened up a whole new field of catalysis for polymer research, and they were attractive enough that I think that the industry could well be depended on to push those, and they did. I mean, I don't think they need it anymore.
No. I was thinking perhaps of the research at the university, if there had been a sort of body overseeing more research at the university, perhaps.
Yeah, well, they're still... universities are... of course, the National Science Foundation can pick up and support university research, and they should... they should have funding enough to pick up the most noteworthy proposals, I think. So I think it's probably all right the way it is.
How did it find the end? I mean, were there any informal ceremonies either in 1955 or 1957 when the whole thing finally ended?
Well, it all went very smoothly. I don't think there was any...
I mean, you didn't all meet in your office to...
No, I had no...
Or something like that.
No hand wringing or tear dripping ceremony.
You just emptied
it. No, just went out and folded up and picked up her marbles and left.
But I mean, in 1957, when you left, you just simply cleared your dress.
Oh, when I left in 57, that had all dwindled down pretty much. I was the only one left then.
Were you? Mm. The final survivor of the great program.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's have a look at one or two general aspects of the synthetic rubber program now. Would you say that, what would you nominate as the three or maybe four most important research centres in World War II, not distinguishing between the academic and the industrial lab? I mean, who were the biggies? Who were the most important ones, do you think?
Research centers. Well, the only way I could say that is you'd have to class the universities all as one, the Akron, the Government Laboratories Akron is another, and the tire test fleet is another. Of course, the tire test fleet isn't a research center, but if it didn't have that, we wouldn't have any feedback into the program. And of course, all the companies had research except the General Tire didn't. General Tire was sort of active, but they had a kind of a bobtailed research agreement that didn't encompass the full extent as the other four companies did, so they were, let's say, not a.
You wouldn't sort of say, oh, you know, really lab at such and such, and the lab in so and so were really key research centers in the World War II period.
Well, see, there was a. The lab, the U.S. Rubber Lab at Naugatuck did a lot. The Goodyear Lab did a lot. The Goodrich did a lot. The Firestone Lab did a lot. The Government Laboratories did an awful lot. They did more pilot plant work than any other one laboratory. Some of the some of the plant laboratories had pilot plants that did a certain amount of work, the development work. It wasn't so much research as the head office research labs were. But it's awfully hard to pick out. If you picked out one, you'd have to pick out another, and then went on another, and you get them all. The whole thing was a program.
Well, what about the personality involved? I mean, we've talked about some of the people who worked in the project. Are there sort of any other key personalities you particularly remember? Were particularly important?
Well, of course, you can name a lot of university people. Dr. Marvel comes to mind right away. Of course, Peter DeBry was a Nobel laureate, and Harkins at the University of Chicago, Karash at the University of Chicago. Pete Koltoff at the University of Minnesota. Whitby, of course, at the University of Akron was a good number. Avery Morton at MIT had a synthesis that was not far away from the Ziegler process, but didn't quite make the grade. It was a non-aqueous, like Ziegler's. It wasn't an emulsion polymerization.
What about the post-war period? I mean, who would you say were the key people in the post-war period, apart from the people we've already mentioned? Did any sort of new stars appear on these guys?
Oh, the Phillips Petroleum, I should have mentioned them before. They were very... very active. They supplied the rubber for the first full-fledged cold rubber tire test, and of course that Lakeshore tire plant was active among the tire plants and. Testing new polymers for us. Of course, the other tire companies did too. Goodyear, Firestone, U.S. Rubber, Copolymer Corporation did a nice job in among the plants that have their own pilot plant laboratory down in Baton Rouge. Goodyear, Akron. The Palmer plant had a pilot plant along with it. The Naugatuck had a pilot plant.
But as a matter of interest, we've decided to concentrate our own historical research effort on the University of Illinois, Bell Laboratories. And the SO Chemical Lab at Linden,
as it's in
from the process. During World War II, for example. What I would like to ask now is, I'm going to give some names, and I would like to ask, to help to shed any light on them. And of course, the first person I have in mind is Carl Marvel.
Yeah, well, Leighton was one too.
Yeah.
Herb Leighton.
Right.
At Illinois.
Right. Then
I went down to Florida later.
No. Anything about the Illinois work? Were you out to sort of make any?
Well, I would say a large part of his work was centered on testing out various monomers, various soap, various kinds of soap, and polymerization recipes generally. So I think that would pretty well characterize it. I mean, among the.
Would you say that Urbana was perhaps, one of the most important research centers during World War II? I mean, if it arrived rain, the thing did it.
Well, it was one of the most important of the research to have them. You might make a distinction between basic research and applied research. I guess we call his all the universities might be considered basic research.
Mm-hmm. What about William Baker? Did you ever come across him much?
Well, of course he contributed a lot to the business about jail and the structure of the polymer, but I don't remember of any particular laboratory he was affiliated with in the program.
Bell Lab.
Of course, the Bell Labs, but that was pretty early in the program. I don't think carried on into the...
No, they didn't carry on after the war. No. What about Paul Fleury?
Oh, well, Fleury was very—he was one of the strongest on the physical chemistry side in the program. He was an investigator in the program for a long period. He was at Goodyear at one time, but then he was at Cornell and he was at the Mellon Institute. I think when he last, I don't know where he was when he woke up or not. Let's see.
Well, he ended up in Stanford eventually.
Stanford, but I think here he was at Mellon. Let's see.
Right, he was at Mellon when the project ended. Mm.
See, the last year of the program we had.
Okay, well,
you're not interested in that. Let's see here. Where's Mellon?
Yeah. I just wanted to know, your own personal impression. And he was perhaps the one you knew best. What was your personal impression?
Koltoff was very active. Pete Koltoff, I.M. Koltoff at Minnesota. I'll run down the name of the universities here again. Chicago, I guess, Karach is the one that comes to mind, although Hawkins was good there too.
Yeah.
At Case, there was Sam Marin. At Akron was G.S. Whitby.
Right.
And Cornell was DeBye, of course. At Delaware, we had a coal burner for a while on distillation. At MIT, we had Avery Morton. Of course, the National Bureau of Standards was active on a lot of things. We had...
Could we move on to another sort of slightly different question, which is that the research side of the synthetic rubber project that the graph you gave me illustrates well would always more in terms of overall funding,
yeah.
2%, 3%. This is in contrast to, say, the Manhattan Project, or even in a commercial company like DuPont, where I'm sure the percentage figure is probably higher. Why was the funding not always set to comparatively low levels?
Well, you're speaking about this.
Talking about that graph, yeah. I mean, the funding is never all that great in terms of the overall production.
Well, it runs around 2%. That's about the same as it is for most chemical companies.
That's right.
But DuPont, they spend a little more. And some of these, like the electronics companies, spend a lot more.
Right.
And, we always had that business about, We can't, it was hard to get more money for it. They thought they had to justify everything, and...
You don't think it could have been any bigger? You feel that...
It could have been bigger, sure, but... Everybody in the research, in charge of research, usually tried to get more money, but they thought that it couldn't justify anymore.
Mm-hmm. One reason why the Center for History of Chemistry is producing a history of the synthetic wartime project, synthetic rubber wartime project, is because so many scientists who work in it insist, like William Baker, for example, insist that it was the key period of their life. In terms of their work. What would you say to that?
Oh, it was a key period in my life, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah,
it sure was.
The polymer scientists also argue that the wartime research laid the foundation of modern polymer science, not only intellectually, but also in terms of facilities and qualified personnel. What would you say to that?
Well, I think that's absolutely true, yeah. I mean, these three things are the cold rubber and oil extension and the cis polyisoprene especially the last two, that one getting the cis polyisoprene out of a different catalytic system than the polymer and the emulsion polymer we have been playing with. That opened up a whole new field, you see, and it's the industry has been running out of breath with that ever since. Many new polymers now.
Are there any other long-term results of the program that you'd like to mention that you feel are important?
Well, there's. It showed that you could start from scratch, almost, and build a whole new industry to operate within an 18-month or two-year period.
Right.
That's when you consider what was done in such a short time, just to build all those plants is just amazing. When you consider you're handling things like butadiene and gas under pressure and styrene, which is an organic chemical that has some problems, and all these things have to be put together and make a product that you want in a tonnage that's used roughly 1 million tons a year. It's an amazing undertaking. Somebody compares it to the problem we have with fuels, but it's a different thing. It can't really be compared. We thought that was a big program, but to put synthetic fuels on the same basis, you'd have to have... That was a big program, but synthetic fuels to replace our consumption of gasoline would take 1,000 times as big a program as that.
Well, in fact, an interesting one in that was that one of Morris Morton's stories is that he says, in World War II, we produced synthetic rubber. We produced, at the end of the war, we could produce 1 million tons a year. Then he says, if we were to do the same with synthetic fuel, you would have to produce 3 million tons. And then he hesitates, and he smiles, and he says, a day.
Yeah, you can't make a parallel with the two on the basis of quantity. Their size.
But how would you rank the synthetic rubber project alongside other famous synthetic projects, scientific projects, like the Manhattan Project, the space program, things like that? I mean, what would you say?
Well, I think it's at least equal to any of the others.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's at least equal to any of the others in quality of accomplishment. Quality and quantity of accomplishment.
If I may ask for a moment as a devil's advocate, I would like to make a, raise a point made by Professor Robert Solow, of whom you may,
you
may have heard, who argued that companies, rubber companies and such like, deliberately refrain from creating wholly new development in polymer science while the exchange agreement was in force. And then suddenly, when all the restraints were off, they sort of started producing new developments all the time. What would you say to that?
Oh, I don't think... I don't think that's true. I think... the only thing new I can see, basically, are these use of the Ziegler type catalysts since then, and those things wouldn't have come along as soon if they hadn't had all this background work in synthetic rubber, that they had the organizations all there and scratching their heads and everything, and it was still within the scope of the program.
Right, fine. But Solow goes on to argue from that debatable premise that the post-war research and development program was therefore doomed to be an expensive failure.
Well, an expensive failure. Well, actually, they, of course, they sold all the plants for, some people say, more than they cost, but I don't know whether they quite did that. This book says they got
they made the money. They
almost all the little bit back from the value. This I have a thing over here from Munster, who was in the production department of the program. I don't know if you've seen this.
I have seen that, yeah.
You have this. Well, Munster says the sale of the plants brought a total return of $270 million, and the taxpayers are out of the pot at $128 million net construction costs plus operating, which plus the non-operating deficits would raise the total cost to $260 million. So he says we ended up $10 million to the good.
But to what extent is that related to the research and development, though? Or is it different from just the hard cost of the pound, the hard value of the pound? I mean, what you're really saying, I suppose, is that because of all the research and development that was done, people were willing to pay more.
Oh, yeah. If it hadn't been for cold rubber and oil extension, the cold rubber anyway, you probably couldn't have sold the plants for anything more than scrap. That one's not scrap value, but.
It increased the value of
Okay,
fine. Very good point. Now, from your experience of the research and development program, what general lessons, if any, would you draw about government industry research programs? I mean, do you think they're a good idea if the circumstances are right?
Well, I don't know if they had to do another job that was anything like this. I think you ought to do it just about the same way.
Right. Mm. I mean, from your experience in the field, you've talked about the SynFuel program. Is there any more you want to say about the apparently ill-fated SynFuel program? Or do you think we've covered that enough?
What was that?
Well, you know, making synthetic fuels.
Oh, synthetic fuels. Oh, yeah. Well, that's a mind-boggling thing. The quantity required and the trouble with trying to get it out of shale and the water requirements and I think they certainly ought to do everything we can to economize, but certainly we could. Uh, What we need is liquid fuels for the cars, assuming we're going to keep running cars. And we probably ought to replace wherever we're just burning liquid fuels in stationary equipment. We ought to change over to gas or coal, and wherever we can replace the liquid fuels with some other liquid like methanol, we probably ought to do that.
Mm-hmm. But what about economization? I mean, Johnny, there could be quite a lot of fuel saved by...
Yeah, you can economize by more heat exchangers and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.